impulses and frailties of character. Would that generosity of spirit work for or against her? And now the bailiff announced that court was in session. She watched as the jury came in through a side door and took seats in the box. She wished she could have gotten more than one person of color on the jury, but it was what it was. Judge Quirk welcomed the jury and spent a little time giving them instructions and answering questions. Then he turned his bespectacled eyes on her.
Ms. Castellano, are you ready to begin?
Yes, Your Honor.
Go get 'em, Natalie said, her voice carrying in the lull. There was a smattering of laughter. Yuki pushed back her chair and, propelled by an adrenaline rush, walked to the lectern in the center of the well. Chapter 57. As Yuki stood behind the lectern, she felt warm all over, her heart and adrenal glands giving her a little more rush than she actually needed. But she composed herself and lifted her eyes and said to the jurors,
"Good morning, everyone. I represent the family of Aaron Ray Cordell, a 15-year-old boy with a below-average IQ who was arrested, then bullied, by two very experienced police officers who deprived this young man of sleep for 16 hours, lied to him about his right to counsel, and induced him to confess to a crime he did not commit. After being coerced into giving a false confession, Aaron Ray was incarcerated and was murdered while awaiting trial. Why was Aaron Ray coerced? Why did he have to die? Because the police had no witnesses, but they had a suspect, and they were going to make sure they nailed him, which they did."
Yuki paused to make sure she had the jurors' attention. Then she continued.
"Here's what happened in February of this year. Aaron Ray was hanging out at the neighborhood crack house after school. If he had lived in a different neighborhood, maybe he would have spent after-school hours in the gym or at a friend's house. But this crack house was a block from where he lived with his parents, and to him, it was where he waited until his folks came home from work. You will hear from witnesses who will tell you that Aaron Ray didn't use drugs. He just liked to be around the big boys at that house, who teased him and made him laugh and sent him out for cigarettes and treated him like a mascot. On this particular day, Aaron Ray was on the top floor of the drug house at 463 Dodge Place when unknown persons robbed and killed three drug dealers on the floor below, then fled the scene, along with all the other people who were in the house at that time. Aaron Ray had an IQ of 70, which is 30 points below average. He was functional, and he was also exceptionally inquisitive, trusting, and childlike. After this shooting occurred and the scores of people ran down the stairs, Aaron Ray also ran. As he told the police and others, he was on his way out of the house when he found a gun on the stairs, which he stuck into the waistband of his pants, like the big boys do. He had this gun in his possession as he ran east on Turk, a very scared and freaked out boy of 15. Two patrolmen in a cruiser witnessed Aaron Ray running along Turk Street. They turned on their lights and sirens and ran their car up on the sidewalk, after which they tackled Aaron Ray to the ground. And what did Aaron Ray say, ladies and gentlemen? He said, "I didn't do it." You will hear these patrolmen tell you that when they asked him what he didn't do, Aaron Ray said he didn't shoot the three men in the drug house. Aaron Ray was brought into the police station for questioning, where two senior narcotics detectives seized on an opportunity to close three homicides in the easiest possible way. Aaron Ray was slow, and he was gullible, and he was under arrest. Over half the day and most of the night, Aaron Ray Cordell repeatedly denied shooting anyone. But as you will see on the video, Inspectors Whitney and Brand convinced Aaron Ray to waive his right to counsel and to having his parents present. They bullied, cajoled, and flat-out lied until this boy, by now helplessly confused, finally said, "I did it." Once Aaron Ray made this false admission, he was jailed pending trial and was subsequently murdered in the showers. We can only hope that he died quickly and that he wasn't in pain. This is Erin Ray,
Yuki said, holding up a photo of her dead client cuddling with his baby sister. He had been a handsome young man, and the expression on his face showed his affection for his sister.
Yuki said, Erin Ray was sweet. He was innocent. And he could not, did not, kill three hardened crack dealers. He didn't know how to load and shoot a gun, and the defense will not say otherwise. Furthermore, during all those hours of interrogation, the police never tested Erin Ray's hands or clothes for gunpowder residue. The police did not bring in any of the habitués of that drug house for questioning and did not consider any other suspects. Erin Ray was the only one they needed. At the end of this trial, you're going to be asked to decide if Erin Ray Cordell's confession was coerced. If it was coerced, it wasn't a confession, and you must hold the SFPD and the city of San Francisco accountable for this innocent boy's cruel, unwarranted, and untimely death.
Chapter 58. Parisi got heavily to his feet and, ignoring the lectern, walked directly to the jury box. He smiled, greeted the jurors, and said a few words about how important jury duty was, adding that as the district attorney for the city of San Francisco, he could not do his job without good people deciding verdicts in trials like this one. He noted how important it was to make sure that justice was always done. Yuki watched him perform, her mind splitting between her good feelings toward Len Parisi, based on 5 years of working with him, learning from him, and supporting him in her capacity as an assistant DA, and the other side of her brain, which was not yet accustomed to thinking of Len as her enemy, which he surely was. Furthermore, Len's calm and personable demeanor made her feel that her own presentation had been borderline hysterical. Even Natalie seemed transfixed by Red Dog. Len put his hand on the railing and walked along it, making eye contact with the jurors as he said,
I have to commend opposing counsel for presenting such a pretty picture of Erin Ray Cordell, but I'm very sorry to say, that's not who he was. Erin Ray was hanging around at a crack house for the same reason anyone goes to a crack house. He used drugs. He didn't just go there after school. He went there instead of going to school. At least he did most days. And I have to say, Ms. Castellano has no idea whether Erin Ray picked up the murder weapon on the stairs as he was leaving the crack house, or whether he picked up the gun inside the crack house, or whether someone gave him a few bucks and told him, here's a gun, Erin Ray, shoot those dudes. So that's what he did. I think the crack house closed-circuit TV cameras were down that day.
The jurors laughed. Yes, he was winning them over.
Len continued, No one has come forward to say that they saw what went down inside that crack house, and no one ever will. I will agree with Ms. Castellano that a gunshot residue test was not performed on Erin Ray. That was a mistake. But what Ms. Castellano didn't tell you is that the bullets that killed those three men came from the gun in Erin Ray's pants. We will put the gun into Mr. Cordell's hand, and there will be no question at all, no dispute, that he had the gun in his possession. He had the murder weapon on his person. He ran, and he told the officers who pulled him in that he had not killed three people in the drug house, and then he named them. The police officers asked him where he got the gun, and he said he found it. And they found three dead men, and they arrested Erin Ray Cordell. Of course they did. That was their job. So, you might ask, how did Erin Ray get that gun? Well, he's not around to tell us now, and it doesn't matter how he got it. It was the murder weapon, and when he had the chance to tell us what happened in that crack house, he told the narcotics investigators that he killed A. Biggie and Dwayne and Double D. But this trial is not about where the gun came from or who shot those drug dealers. It is also not about who killed Erin Ray Cordell. As Ms. Castellano said, this trial is only about one thing. Did inspectors Stanley Whitney and William Brand from Narcotics coerce Erin Ray into making a false confession? We say they did not. Did they use legitimate interview techniques? Yes, they did. Did they lie? Very likely. An interview in a police station is like a lying competition where both parties lie and bluff and do whatever they can to get the other party to believe them. It's legal for police to lie. And when we show you clips from the interview, you are going to see that this young man was cool, calm, and collected, and that he confessed to murdering three men. So when he confessed, Inspectors Brand and Whitney put him in jail, where he belonged, because killers shouldn't be loose on the street. Erin Ray was in jail awaiting his speedy trial, as was his right as an American, when an incredibly unfortunate incident happened. And we're sorry for the pain of Erin Ray's family. But Erin Ray's death was not the fault of the San Francisco Police Department. Chapter 59. The funeral of the Calhoun family was held at Cypress Lawn Memorial Park in Colma. It was one of the most emotionally devastating events I'd ever attended. Marie Calhoun's father, Tom Calhoun's father, the boys' little league coach, and their homeroom teacher all gave eulogies. The SFPD was also represented at the service by Chief Jacoby, Sergeant Phil Pekelny from robbery, and Inspector Ted Swanson, who choked out a few words about what a good kid Calhoun had been. Hundreds of cops in dress blues packed the chapel and spilled outside, many of them crying, and they formed a thick blue wall behind the broken family at the graveside, where four caskets, two of them child size, were slowly lowered into the ground. The pervasive grief was cut with anger that these hideous, nauseating deaths had happened, and had happened to a cop and his family. I'd hardly known Calhoun, but I vividly remembered his optimism that morning at the check cashing store, where three copycat windbreaker cops had been gunned down by passing patrolmen. And that thought nagged me and wouldn't quite let me go. Finally, the funeral was over. Conklin and I climbed up into his Bronco and crept along with the traffic moving out of the cemetery. We slowly passed the block where my mother was buried, and then the place where Yuki's hilarious mother, Keiko, had been laid to rest. Washed over by images of so many other funerals, we left Colma and took 101 back to San Francisco. When we were within the city limits, I wanted to hit a saloon, a quiet one where old barflies would be watching a ball game and where no one knew my name. I wanted time and space to get my feelings under control before I went home to my family. But Conklin said,
"I want to look at the Calhoun house again."
"Why, Rich?"
"I just do."
I sighed. "Okay, if that's what you want, that's what we'll do." Chapter 60. Conklin parked in front of the green house on Texas Street. We sat quietly for a moment under a telephone line loaded with blackbirds, then got out, ducked under the tape, broke the seal on the front door, and shouldered it open. The murder house had no trace of life in it, but it smelled bad, and in the seconds before we threw on the lights, I could almost hear Marie Calhoun screaming. Finally, I suggested we each take a room and try to look at it with fresh eyes. Conklin wanted to see the boys' room. I took the kitchen. The first thing I saw was the spoon and bowl in the sink with the remains of a helping of chocolate chip ice cream. I imagined that this had been someone's last meal. There were blood-spattered drawings of Easter rabbits and Little League baseball schedules stuck up on the fridge with magnets, 5 feet above the chalk marks on the linoleum floor where Marie Calhoun's body had come to rest. The refrigerator door was open, and the food had gone bad. The smell of rotting meat permeated the room. I looked into the trash can just in case it had been forgotten, but the garbage had gone to the lab and the bin was empty. The knife block on the counter had one knife missing, presumably the paring knife, which likely had been used to slice the lids off Tom Calhoun's eyes. I tried to take my own advice to look at this scene as if for the first time, but it was impossible to keep any distance from a multiple homicide, especially one like this. The word that kept echoing in my mind was why. Brady had wondered out loud if Calhoun was one of the Windbreaker cops. Wondered if he had had knowledge about the large stash of drugs we assumed had been the reason Wicker House had been robbed and the lab rats killed. I trusted Brady's instincts. So if Calhoun was one of those renegade cops, he wasn't alone. Could he be working with other cops? Could Swanson, Vasquez, even Robertson be part of the crew? Conklin, too, had thoughts that Wicker House and this quadruple murder were related. I heard his footsteps and turned as he came into the kitchen. He said,
Linz, there's nothing new upstairs. It was a straight-up execution. I don't see signs of a robbery. As Clapper said, nothing was tossed.
Who killed them? I asked my partner, but I was really asking myself.
What do you think, Linz?
Let's say Brady is right, that Calhoun may be one of the Windbreaker cops. Calhoun was pretty excited by those dead Windbreaker-wearing copycats, remember? Conklin nodded. It was like he was saying, Yahoo, the case is closed. And maybe it was because if he could convince us that the Windbreaker case was solved, there'd be no heat on him.
Go on,
said my partner. Okay, I said. Let's take it a step further. If Calhoun was involved in the Wicker House robbery, those drugs were worth a lot to someone. And that someone? Let's say it was Kingfisher. What if Kingfisher knew who robbed him?
Oh, okay. So you're saying maybe this wasn't torture for information, Conklin said. Maybe the Calhoun family was the message. Screw with us, this happens.
It's a leap, I said, staring at the blood on the kitchen floor. Conklin said,
It's a leap, but it makes more sense than anything I've heard so far.
Chapter 61. I was home before dinner, and after showering and changing into sweats, I took Julie onto my lap and fed her strained lamb and peas while listening to Valerie June singing Pushin' Against a Stone. After that, I put Julie in Joe's arms. I filled Martha's bowl with a premium kibble I'd been saving for a special occasion, and I told Joe I was cooking dinner. I have to do something that I can control and that will make me feel like I'm doing something good.
You had me at I'm cooking, Joe said.
I laughed, first time that day, and even laughed a little too long and hard. My husband joined in, then gave me a glass of cold orange juice, which is our code for chill. As I chopped vegetables, I told Joe about my shitty day.
I said I'd go with you to Colma, he told me.
Nah, it was better I went with the troops. I gave Joe a brief verbal tour of the after-funeral return to the Calhoun's House of Horrors. And while I pounded the veal cutlets with a mallet, I told him my thoughts that Kingfisher had been involved. When the cutlets were so thin they were almost transparent, I felt Joe gently taking the mallet out of my hand. I laughed again, which was very cathartic, I've got to say. While I sipped my juice, Joe talked about drug kingpins he has known and about Kingfisher in particular, a brutal psychopath who earned his name by annihilating anyone who got in his way.
He's both a legend and a myth, Joe said. No one knows what he looks like, but it's said that he gets a piece of all the drug action in the state. Or else.
Yeah, I sighed.
Not to over-worry, Linz, but you think Kingfisher's gang tortured a cop who may have been involved in the case you're working.
Right, I know, I said. I know. The oil and the veal were sizzling in the pan, and Joe poured the wine.
Linz, it concerns me.
I'll be careful. I won't take any unnecessary chances. Joe nodded. He set the security system while I dished up dinner. We ate at the dining table for a change, Martha sitting hopefully between our chairs. When the coffee was brewing, Joe changed the subject and told me he had a lead on his case, Claire's birthday murders.
I've got a possible suspect, Joe said. His name is Wayne Broward, and he was charged with slashing a neighbor's car tires. The judge fined him, and Broward responded by threatening to kill the judge
rape his wife, and suffocate their children. Whoa, a seriously crazy person. He was sentenced to the max for threatening a judge, which is a $5,000 fine and a year in the Huskow. Broward got out early for good behavior. You ask, when was that? And I answer, just before Claire's birthday 5 years ago. Huh, I said. Let's see what else you've got.
While I cleaned up, Joe brought over his laptop. I looked at the files he had found, then tapped into the SFPD database and looked up this madman, Wayne Lawrence Broward, who lived in the Bayview neighborhood at Hollister Avenue and Hawes Street. Apart from the attack on the neighbor's tires, Broward had a record for assault on a neighbor who had put his garbage cans too close to Broward's driveway. And in addition to these attacks, there was a domestic abuse complaint from Broward's wife. She had dropped the charges, but her statement made interesting reading. Joe, listen to this. Mrs. Broward described her husband as ruined by his crazy-ass schizo mother and has intermittent explosive anger disorder.
And she stuck with him.
Yes, she did. If I can find a spare moment tomorrow, I'm going to check up on this guy, I said.
Be very careful, said my dear husband.
Chapter 62. Wayne Lawrence Broward's house was a brown, wood-shingled shanty, the third one in from the intersection of Hollister Avenue and Hawes Street. Standing behind a chain-link fence that was hung with a dozen no-trespassing signs, the house looked like a seething box of paranoia. I parked in front of the fence and clipped my badge to my lapel so that the gold medal would glint against the navy blue twill. I unbuttoned my jacket so that my gun was visible on my hip. Then I pushed open the short chain-link gate. Even as I put my hand on the gate, I knew I was way off the rails here. Tina Strickler's murder was being worked by Inspectors Michaels and Wang of our department, but even though they were new, or maybe because of that, I didn't feel comfortable asking them to look into a fairly baseless hunch conceived by Joe and me. Still, a hunch was hard to put aside, and I had to check it out. I went through the gate and up the poured cement path to the front door, upon which was taped another no trespassing and that means you notice. I pressed the buzzer. I heard a dog woofing deep inside the house, and a man's voice said,
Okay, Hauser, let's see who this damned son of a bitch is.
There were sounds behind the door. A peephole sliding, a chain coming off a track, a bolt unracking. Given the modest means of residents of this neighborhood, either Wayne Broward was stashing gold bullion at home, or he was an officer in a one-man war. Or maybe he had stabbed a woman to death on each of the past 5 May 12ths. There was more barking, and then the door was pulled open. A brown-haired white man of average height and weight, in a denim shirt and jeans, holding a Winchester rifle, showed himself in the slice of open doorway.
What the fuck do you want?
He asked. I'm Sergeant Lindsay Boxer, I said, showing him my badge. I'm looking for Wayne Lawrence Broward. The dog, a boxer, as it turned out, lunged at the door, and the gent with the rifle used his leg to push the dog back from the doorway.
I said, what the fuck do you want?
I pushed my badge forward. I'm the police. Put the gun down. The man in the doorway scowled, but he lowered the muzzle. I took a photo of Tina Strickler from my breast pocket. Her bloody death on a pedestrian crossing in front of about 100 tourists was still vivid in my mind. I said, do you know this woman? Broward peered at the photo, then opened the door wide and said,
Why didn't you say so? Come in.
Chapter 63. Broward had as much as said he recognized Tina Strickler, but I wanted to hear him actually say it. You know this woman? I asked.
Come in, he said. I don't bite. Even Hauser don't bite.
He yanked on the dog's collar, shoved the dog into a bedroom, and closed the door. I put my hand on my gun, cautiously entered the house, and looked around. The interior of the place looked like American Pickers meets hoarding, buried alive. There wasn't one inch of clean or uncluttered surface. There were live chickens in a slatted box under a table, canned food stacked against the walls to the ceiling, boxes of ammo on countertops, and guns hanging from racks on the walls. I scanned the room for trophies of dead women. I was looking for photos or newspaper clippings taped to the wall or signs of the abused wife. I also looked for a collection of assorted knives that might have been used to commit murder and then been taken away by the killer. But mainly, I was so stunned by the chaos that I lost sight of Broward until I felt a cold gun muzzle against the back of my neck. Wayne Broward said, "Why don't you take off your gun and stay a while?" "Love to," I said, fear and shame flooding my body to my fingertips and out through my eyes. I was a jerk. I'd walked right into this, and I might die in this very room. "I'm taking my gun out very slowly," I said, my back to him, "just using my fingertips." As I was trained to do, I spun around fast, knocked the barrel of Broward's rifle away from me, grabbed the rifle with both hands, and wrenched it out of Broward's grip, throwing him off balance. I flung the rifle far from where I stood. As it clattered against a wall hung with hubcaps, I pulled my Glock and leveled it at Broward's nose. From the chill at the back of my neck to the Glock in my hand took about 10 seconds, but it felt like the last 10 seconds of my life. Hauser was barking his head off, and I wondered at my luck that Broward had underestimated me and had put the dog behind a door. "Bitch," Broward spat at me. "I should have shot you. I could have done anything to you. No one would ever know what happened to you." "Turn around. Put your hands on your head," I said. He did it.
"I could have given you a real good ride first," he said mournfully. "I haven't had a blonde in a while."
"Shut the hell up," I said. I holstered my gun, wrenched Broward's arms down, and cuffed him behind his back. "You're under arrest for assault on a police officer," I said. And then I read him his rights. Chapter 64. I had Broward in the back of my vehicle, behind the plexiglass, and in cuffs. As for me, I was still twitching with adrenaline because he could have killed me. That would have been my fault entirely for having made such a dumbass rookie mistake. I couldn't stop flicking my eyes to the rearview mirror to look at him. He was wild-eyed crazy for sure, but whatever kind of psycho he was, he didn't seem to know or care that he was on his way to jail. Broward said loudly,
"Remember when we were living with my mama?"
"Yep, it was a trip, Wayne."
"You used to call me Honey Boy. I just loved when you did that."
"That was then, Wayne," I said, playing along. "I'm over you now." Wayne Broward began to sing Jesus Loves Me. I turned up the squawk box and kept my eyes on the road. I didn't like what I was going to have to say to a judge about why I had been inside the house of a man who hadn't been under suspicion of anything. My probable cause was a hunch. Thank God Broward had invited me to come in. Perhaps that and his history of threatening a judge would help me sound a little less stupid. 20 minutes later, I parked in the all-day lot on Bryant and tossed the keys to the guy who worked days in the shed. Broward gave me no trouble as I escorted him across the street and into the building in cuffs. I walked him through the metal detector and up the stairs to the desk sergeant on the 3rd floor. I said, "Sergeant, we need to book Mr. Broward for assault with a deadly weapon on a police officer. Make sure he gets a psych eval." Sergeant Brooks asked questions and filled out a form, and a uniformed cop came up and took Broward to booking. My rifle-wielding collar would be kept busy for the next 24 to 36 hours while being processed. There would be a body search, fingerprints, a shower, and examinations by a nurse and a shrink. Then he'd be given a jumpsuit and locked in a holding cell until I could get back to him. After leaving the front desk, I went down the hall and through the door to homicide. I found Conklin in the bullpen with files on drug dealers fanned out all over his desktop. "Rich, I'm very sorry. I got hung up." I fully planned to tell my partner about Wayne Broward, but he cut in with a news flash.
"Ralph Valdin was hit."
Ralph Valdin, a.k.a. Rascal, was one of the two former stockroom boys at Wicker House. Valdin had been charged with assault on a police officer for that punch he'd thrown at Conklin at the ballpark. But he'd been released on bail. Unlike Donnie Wolf, who had stolen a car, we had nothing else on Valdin. There was no evidence that he knew the Wicker House shooters or that he knew what happened to the drugs that had been stolen from that lab. "What happened?" I asked my partner.
"His mom went over to his place and found him dead in the bedroom," Conklin said. "Two shots to the chest, one to the head. Makes me think someone was cleaning up after themselves. Maybe he could have ID'd the Wicker House shooters."
"Another dead witness," I said.
"And he's all ours," said Conklin.
Chapter 65. Brady held an impromptu standing room only meeting at the end of the shift. We were a ragged-looking crew, but highly motivated to stop the growing body count and rescue our reputation, which was getting trashed by the media daily, nightly, and on weekends. Brady is a hard ass, but he wasn't saying, "You guys." He said,
"We have a big problem. All of us. More than a dozen people are dead, including one of our own and his family. Some of the dead are victims of crimes, some are witnesses, and some are perps. I'll be frank, I'm not sure we always know who is who. This is what I see. The nature of the war between the drug dealers and us has changed. Cops may be involved in drug-related crime, and drug dealers are firing back. No one can say with certainty who is doing what to whom, and that makes it even more, I don't know, disgusting. This cannot go on. Everyone here, you are all working a piece of this war. Talk to your CIs. Think about things that have been said or done, and you look the other way. I don't want any crap about never ratting out a brother. One of our brothers was tortured before he and his family were murdered. This was a first in my experience, and I don't have to tell you that this can never happen again. My door is open to all of you. If you have a clue, even if it involves someone we know and trust, you tell me in private."
Brady paced a little in front of the room, then asked if there were any questions. There were none. There were no strangers in our bullpen, just people who'd had our backs for years. One of them had left an anonymous note on my desk saying, "Watch your back." Brady went on.
"Boxer and Conklin are primaries on Wicker House, and the homicides of Tom Calhoun and his family. If you're assigned to those cases, report to them. Swanson and Vasquez are responsible for the Mercado and check-cashing robbery homicides, past, present, and future. Whitney and Brand are point men on cases where drug dealers have been shot. Any information about dealers being ripped off or killed by cops, report immediately to me. My cell phone number and private email address are posted in the break room. We're smart enough to put this trouble down, so let's do that. Vacations are canceled. That's all."
The meeting broke up, and Brady made his way through the room full of cops to his office. When Conklin and I reached our desks, I picked up the phone. I called the men's jail and in just a few minutes had set up a room for a conference with a car thief and former Wicker House stockroom boy by the name of Donald Wolf. Chapter 66. Donnie Wolf looked to be in a pretty good mood when he was brought into the interview room in orange jumpsuit and cuffs.
"What's up?" he said,
sliding into a chair as the guard left the room. He angled around in his seat, getting comfortable, enjoying the attention, or maybe just happy to have company.
"You making me miss my dinner."
Conklin said,
"I've got some bad news for you, Donnie."
"Oh, yeah?"
"Someone took out your friend Rascal."
"Nuh-uh. No, they didn't."
Conklin took his phone out of his pocket and found the photo of Ralph Valdean lying face down on his narrow bed, his blood soaking through the baby blue covers. Conklin put the phone on the table and turned it so that Donnie Wolf could see the picture. For a moment, you could see the young kid in Wolf. His eyes got big, he drew back, and then only a moment later, he disguised his shock and took on the cocky scowl of a criminal with aspirations to become a bigger, better criminal.
"You faked that picture," he said, "trying to scare me."
"Really?"
Conklin said.
"You really think we staged this blood and brains on the headboard to shake you up?"
"Sure, why not?"
"Because, Donnie, we don't need to scare you. You're in a cell. You've got a trial coming up, and you'll be convicted of grand theft, and you will go to prison for a long time. You might get out in time to see your unborn baby get married."
A long minute passed, as Donnie seemed to picture that. Then he said,
"Or what?"
This is one of the things I love about Conklin. He's a trustworthy dude. His goodness comes through, even to punks like Donnie.
"Look, we need to know about Valdean," my partner said. "Why was he shot, and who do you think did it? Help us, and we'll tell the DA you cooperated. That will count at sentencing, I promise you that."
A lot of quiet time gathered in the small interview room. I did my best not to fidget as Donnie thought over his options. Then he said,
"How am I supposed to help you? I wasn't there. I don't know why anyone would do that to Rascal."
I had to step in. "Donnie, your friend Rascal Valdean was executed. You see that, don't you? He wasn't shot while holding up a store or stealing a car or screwing someone else's woman. He was shot in his bed while he was asleep."
"No, no, no, no."
"Yes. And this is what I'm thinking, Donnie. Ralph knew something, and someone didn't want him to talk." After a long pause, Donnie said,
"He might have known something that I don't know."
I pressed on. "Did he know who shot up Wicker House? Do you?" Wolf looked up at the camera, then back at Conklin. He said to Conklin,
"Not with that."
Conklin left the room, and when he came back, the red camera light was off.
"Go ahead, Donnie,"
Conklin said.
"Cops did that Wicker House deal."
"What cops?" I asked.
"They was cops. Rascal and me, we told this one of them when the drugs were moving out for distribution. It was just supposed to be a heist. We didn't know they were going to shoot. They didn't tell us that, I swear on my baby soul. I just needed money to go away, and that's all."
Real tears were filling his eyes. He wiped them away, and again I saw the kid in him. "How do you know they were cops?"
"They wearing jackets saying police."
"That's all? Did you see a badge? Were they cops you knew?"
"They talk like cops, they walk like cops, they cops,"
Donnie said. "How many?" I asked.
"I only met the one that made the deal with me and Rascal. I hear on the street could be like five more in the crew. I told the one that paid me, I say, watch your ass. I say to him, those drugs belong to the king."
"Kingfisher? And what did he say?"
"He say, no problem, like, I got this."
Conklin said,
"What's this cop's name? We need his name."
The silence went on for long seconds as Donnie Wolf thought about his odds if he gave us a name and his odds if he didn't. I think it came out as a draw.
"What does he look like?"
Conklin said. Donnie shook his head again, then made a decision.
He said, "Both times I see him, he's sitting in a car. White guy, wears a police cap and big shades. You can only see, like, his nose. And it's just a regular nose."
Conklin asked again in his kind, steady voice,
"What's his name, Donnie?" "One. That's what he said. That's what I call him. Mr. One."
Chapter 67. I'd just gotten home when I got a call from Cindy. She was at the airport just back from her book tour, so I invited her and Richie to come on over to our house for Joe's sausage lasagna.
A half hour later, Julie was in bed, and two of my very favorite people were standing around the kitchen with me and Joe, all of us sampling the fine wine Cindy had picked up at our neighborhood liquor store. Cindy was wearing a butter yellow pullover and jeans and had glittery clips in her curly blonde hair. She stood hip to hip against Richie, and he had his arm around her. They both looked radiant. I loved to see this. Loved it. While I tossed the salad, Cindy told a story about her last stop at the mysterious Galaxy Bookstore in San Diego. A woman had hung back until every one of the 30 people who wanted Cindy to sign their books had moved on. Then, said Cindy, this woman whispered, I have a story I think you'll want to write.
Really? Joe said. A true story?
That's what she said.
Cindy relayed the woman's fairly intense tale of a serial polygamist with 5 wives, each unknown to the other 4. The guy posed as a traveling salesman, but in fact was a con man.
Cindy said, this woman, Nikki, told me, Benny was the sweetest man you'd ever want to meet. Super kind, always attentive. He always made me feel like I was the most important person in the world. Oh, I forgot to say, Benny was my father.
Cindy laughed at the shocked expressions all around her. Then she said,
Nikki said her father disappeared 10 years ago and is presumed dead, but his body has never been found. She wants me to write an expose of her own father and his mysterious disappearance. She wants me to find him, dead or alive, and if he was killed, to find the killer. She's not asking much, right? But I am thinking about it.
Dinner was hot, tasty, and served with plenty of laughs, which I needed. But I was still feeling crappy about my set-to with Wayne L. Broward and couldn't wait to tell Joe about it. I found everything that had happened from the moment I knocked on Broward's door so embarrassing I hadn't even told Conklin. Luckily, Cindy and Rich were eager to take their party home right after dinner. As soon as we'd all hugged and kissed goodbye and I'd checked on Julie, I said to Joe, I did a tremendously stupid thing today. I told him about my lunchtime visit to Wayne Broward and how I'd let the guy get his gun on me. Joe scowled, and I could feel him winding up to remind me that I had a child now. I said, please don't scold me, Joe. I've already had some strong words with myself.
I haven't said anything.
I know, but you'd be within your rights. The guy is wacko. And by that I mean his mind hardly tracks at all. He could be demented. I can't see him making a note to kill a woman every year on May 12th and then doing it and after that getting away with it. I shook my head, thinking about the house piled high with junk, the way Broward's mind veered from past to present, and why I was pretty sure he'd never even focused on my badge. I said,
I turned my back on him. He had a gun.
Come here, said Joe.
I went into my husband's arms, took a few deep breaths, then pulled him to the sofa and leaned against his shoulder. I'm gonna have to tell Brady and Richie about this guy, and after the arraignment, the story is gonna get out. And I'm gonna take some crap for going into the guy's house on a hunch.
It was a dead end. The wrong tree, Joe said. But Tina Strickler's killer is still out there.
True, I said. But I wonder if there really is a pattern to these killings, Joe. Or if linking 5 separate stabbings to one killer with a mind like a clock is all in our minds. It could just as easily be that there are 5 different killers with minds of their own. Chapter 68. It was day 2 of the trial. Yuki had had a rough night. She and Brady were at opposite sides of the justice system, and the so-called Chinese wall was in play. She couldn't talk to him about her case, he couldn't talk to her about his, and that made conversation forced and sleep barely possible. She was at her desk at 7:45, and Natalie arrived a few minutes later with coffee. They picked apart Parisi's opening statement, guessed about what he might be planning to do with their witnesses. Natalie told Yuki not to worry. Zach arrived and stopped in the doorway.
About 12 people texted me about your opening yesterday, he said to Yuki. Mazel tov, and thanks to both of you.
Yuki's mood lifted, and feeling freshly caffeinated, she drove with Natalie to McAllister Street and parked the car in the underground garage. Once in the courtroom, Natalie gave the video disc to the clerk and joined Yuki at the counsel table. They spoke softly to each other as the courtroom filled. The proceedings were called to order. When it was time to present the plaintiff's case, Yuki rose from her seat, walked past the lectern, and approached the jury box. Today, everything depended on the video. She said to the jurors,
"Good morning, everyone. When I made my opening statement yesterday, I said you would see portions of the police department's 16-hour interrogation of Erin Rae Cordell. I also said that this case is about one thing, whether or not Erin Rae was coerced into making a confession. Because if a confession is coerced, it's not a confession. And if Erin Rae didn't confess, then he should not have been jailed. And if he had not been jailed, he would not have died. I've selected portions of the interview to show you, but you'll be able to read the transcript of the interrogation in its entirety."
Yuki told the clerk to play the video disc. The lights dimmed, and the video came up on the flat screen. Erin Rae, heavily built and easily 6 feet tall, sat across a scarred wooden table from two police officers who introduced themselves as William Brand and Stan Whitney. Whitney was in his 30s. He had a close-cropped beard and round, wire-rimmed glasses. He looked more like a science teacher than a narc. From his posture and tone of voice, he appeared to be sympathetic to Erin Rae's distress. He said,
"Is this how it happened, A-Ray? You got scared? Those dealers. Freaking lethal dudes. Armed and dangerous, right? They threatened you and you surprised them, right? You shot them and ran, because if that's what happened, you were protecting yourself, and anyone would understand that."
Erin Rae said,
"I didn't shoot them. I didn't even know they were shot. I found a gun on the stairs and I thought I could make $50. That's wrong because it wasn't my gun. I'm sorry about that."
Whitney said, "Erin, listen, you don't have to lie anymore. What you did is all gonna come out. But if you tell us, we can protect you. That's what you need to do, son."
Yuki showed 5 minutes of Whitney befriending Erin Rae, telling him it was safe to confess.
"Don't you want to go home, Erin Rae? Don't you want this to be over?" "I want to go home."
Whitney passed a piece of paper across the table. He said, "This paper says that we told you what your rights are and that you are waiving them because you don't want a lawyer.
You don't want to complicate this, do you, A-Ray?" "I didn't shoot anyone," Erin Rae said.
Brand said,
"Good for you, A-Ray."
He handed the boy a pen, and Erin Rae signed his name on the line where the detective put his finger. Brand hardly waited for Erin Rae to lift his pen before he whipped the paper away and took it out of the room. Whitney said,
"Feel better now?"
"No,"
said Erin Rae. Yuki used the remote to fast forward to hour 6, which was the point where Inspector Brand took the lead. Chapter 69. The footage rolled, and the jurors' eyes focused on Inspector William Brand's interrogation of Erin Rae. Brand was on his feet. He stalked around the narrow confines of the interview room. He made angry gestures with his arms. At some angles, you could see the tattoo on his neck under his left ear at the collar line. The tattoo was only an inch square and looked like a cow brand of his initials, WB. Brand said to his suspect,
"You signed this waiver, A-Ray, saying you didn't need a lawyer, so now you have to tell the truth. That's what it means. And if you keep lying, you are going to drown in your own crap. Understand?"
"I told you the truth,"
Erin Rae said. He was crying. He put his head down on the table and sobbed into his folded arms.
"You're a liar, Cordell," said Brand. "You make me sick. You're a big man when you have a gun, but look at you now. A lying sack of shit. The worst kind of person. Can't stand up for what he did. And you should get an award for what you did, taking out those dirt bags.
That's what you did, didn't you?
No,
said Aaron Ray.
You dumb piece of crap, said Brand.
He leaned over and shouted in Aaron Ray's face.
I'm trying to help you. Don't you understand? Tell the goddamn truth and end this. Don't you want your parents to be proud that you stood up like a man?
I didn't shoot that gun, Aaron Ray sobbed.
Yuki forwarded the video again. She said to the jury,
This is our 15 and 45 minutes. Aaron Ray has had 3 sodas and a bag of chips. He has waived his rights so that he can go home. That's his understanding, and he has told the truth. But Inspectors Whitney and Brand aren't buying it.
Parisi objected.
Your Honor, the video speaks for itself.
I'll allow it anyway, said Judge Quirk.
Yuki hit play. The placement of the individuals in the room was the same. Brand had his hands in his pockets. He was pacing, and his anger was undisguised. He said,
Last chance I'm giving you to get ahead of this, A-Ray, and then we're done. You're going to jail for the rest of your life, or maybe you'll get the death penalty. Either way, you're never gonna hug your mama again. Or you can tell us what happened. You were high. You were confused, you felt threatened, and so you had to defend yourself and shoot those 3 violent, dangerous men.
Brand sat down, pulled his chair right up to Aaron Ray and put his hand on the back of the boy's neck. Brand said,
It's safe to tell us, eh, Ray? It's now or we're done. I have a family, and I gotta go home. Tell the truth, or the next time I see you, it will be as a witness at your execution. Your mom and pops will be crying, but I'm gonna be saying to them, I told him to tell the truth, but he told me to piss off. Is that how you want this to go?
Aaron Ray picked his head up off the table.
I can go home after?
Yes. What did I say? Start talking, said Brand. Or I'm walking out of here and going home. Unlike you.
Aaron Ray sighed.
All right. I did it, he said. I was scared and so I shot them, all right?
Shot who? Said Whitney.
A Biggie? Dwayne? Double D?
Aaron Ray was crying again.
Good man, said Whitney.
He looked at the two-way mirror, gave a thumbs up. Brand opened the door and uniformed officers came into the room and pulled Aaron Ray Cordell to his feet. Whitney and Brand high-fived and low-fived, and the video went black. Yuki submitted the transcript into evidence and returned to the counsel table. Judge Quirk said,
Miss Castellano, you have a witness?
She was getting a jump on Parisi by calling 2 witnesses who might normally have been called by the defense. In legal terms, they were adverse witnesses, and she could deal with them as if she were cross-examining the opposition witnesses. She hoped she could pull it off.
Plaintiff calls Inspector Stanley Whitney to the stand.
Chapter 70. Narcotics Inspector Stan Whitney wore jeans, a denim shirt, and a striped tie under a navy blue jacket. He looked very respectable and trustworthy, and the wire-rimmed glasses just frosted the cake. He swore on the Bible to tell the whole truth and nothing but, and then he took his seat in the witness box. Yuki spent a few minutes establishing that Whitney had been with the SFPD for 8 years, the first 5 in uniform, the last 3 in narcotics. She asked him to describe his interview with Aaron Ray. Whitney said,
Well, he was like a lot of people who are pinched for committing a crime. Young, old, first-time offender, or career criminal, no one sits down and says, I did it, even if you catch them standing over a body with a gun in their hand and blood all over them.
I see, said Yuki. But since this was a presumed triple homicide, why were detectives from narcotics interrogating the subject?
Mr. Cordell was pulled in for running from a crack house with a gun in his hand. We've run into Mr.